You seek the key, but first you must learn the ways of precision, craft, and performance with Acura's all-electric ZDX. With a premium Bang & Olufsen sound system, up to a 313-mile range, and a Type S variant with an estimated 500 horsepower, the ZDX is their most powerful SUV yet. Unlock the energy when you visit Acura.com to order yours today.
This isn't your average business podcast, and he's not your average host. This is the James Altucher Show on the Choose Yourself Network. Today on the James Altucher Show.
When you left Google, the biggest and best company in the world, for Dropbox, people probably thought you were crazy. Like, Dropbox was this little tiny company at the time. What were you thinking?
Well, when I joined Google, everybody thought I was crazy. It was a little tiny company as well, even though it was small at the time. Play the movie forward. Where is it going to be in 10 years? It's logical to me that the company that pioneered this notion of putting your files in the cloud is going to have all kinds of opportunities and going to solve problems for everybody in the world. And a lot of people don't think that way. They think very linearly. That's how we're taught as kids. That's how you're taught in college. You have to rewire your brain a bit to say, well, what trends do I understand to be true? If I extrapolate that trend to its logical conclusion, what does the world look like?
It's hard to recognize.
It is very hard.
Hey, so Dennis Woodside, COO of Dropbox, one of the fastest growing companies ever, basically. Welcome to the podcast.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
Now, Dennis, you know, we went to college at the same place at the same time.
That's right, Cornell.
But we didn't know each other.
No, we didn't. There were a lot
campus.
Of people there.
Yeah. It's like 20,000 students there.
Yeah.
So, and you lived all the way on the other side of campus anyway. And did you do any sports? I never did any sports or anything.
I did. I rode.
You rode?
Yeah.
What does that mean? Like you played polo?
No, I was in the rowing team, crew.
Oh, row.
Rowing, a boat.
Okay. Okay, so you were sort of like the equivalent of the Winklevoss brothers, but at Cornell.
There you go, just so, like that.
And then you were at Google for many years. Yeah. Now you're at Dropbox.
Yeah.
I want to, like, how did you end up at Google? I know you went to law school. And then I want to get into Dropbox and all of the ways you've kind of reinvented yourself and how you decided to go from a super successful company to when you were at Dropbox, it was still kind of a startup. We'll get into all that. But I just want to know the basic thing. Like, how did you end up at, like, that end of the world?
So I grew up in Philadelphia and then went with you to Cornell. But the big thing that I did at Cornell was rowing. I was actually a national class rower. Two friends of mine wound up going to the Olympics.
I was about to ask if you had gone to the Olympics.
No, two buddies of mine did. But I realized I you can't make a living rowing.
Really? There are no billionaire rowers?
There's no there might. The Winklevosses might be.
Oh, yeah, there you go.
The Bitcoin thing worked out for them so far. So I went out to Stanford for law school, which got me, that's how I got on the West Coast in the first place.
So when you go to Stanford to law school, because that's where Peter Thiel went, did you know those guys?
I didn't know him. He was a couple years before me.
Okay.
And, you know, this, you remember these days, there was no internet. This
right.
was pre-Yahoo. This was pre-email, really. And wound up practicing law for a little bit, worked here in New York for a federal judge on the Second Circuit. So I actually was a lawyer for a period of time. And that was a fascinating job because you're helping the judge decide really critical cases. One of the cases we heard was related to the first attempt to bomb the World Trade Center. Remember?
Oh, wow.
Abdul Rahman drove a bus into the garage of the Trade Center, blew it up.
And was it like 1991?
It was around then. And so you're deciding these very weighty issues. And so it's kind of the pinnacle of legal practice in many ways. And then you become a lawyer, which is a completely different job.
So wait, when you were going over that case, what was the issue, whether he was guilty or not?
He was appealing a fairly technical aspect of his conviction. So he had been convicted in the lower court, and he was appealing that to the appellate court.
So like something went wrong in the conviction.
Exactly. His conviction was affirmed, and he died in jail. But we also heard a case arising out of a conspiracy to bomb all the bridges and tunnels in New York. We heard insider trading cases. I mean, it's a fascinating, fascinating job.
What was the most interesting insider trading case? Because I'm always intrigued by that.
I don't know if you remember Joseph Jett.
So from Morgan Stanley.
I think he was Paine Webber, I believe. But he came up with a scheme that was sort of the pre-Madoff Ponzi scheme, where he just kept buying debt and buying and buying and buying debt. And he hid the bonds trades that he did from everybody else at the bank, and it turned out that they were a huge bust. And so we heard an appeal arising out of his conviction. So it was pretty fascinating work.
So did he get off, or he got out of jail and he made some money somehow?
I think eventually he got out. I don't remember.
And I think they paid him like money to like leave.
To get out of jail?
Or no, to get out of Payne Weber or whatever.
Oh, yeah, they may have.
I think he
they
made some have. Kind of settlement.
Some kind
I don't
of
know.
Deal. I don't remember.
Because there's, you know, in something like that, it's never by yourself. Like
no.
You know, his boss was probably involved. His employees were involved.
Yeah, and I think the company was fined as well.
Yeah.
And I'm probably wrong about Payne Weber. I don't remember the exact bank. So,
well, I think maybe Morgan Stanley might have bought
Payne Weber or something.
Or
like
Dean
this.
Witter or yeah. One of these things happened.
Yeah. Yeah.
So okay. So you're at the judge, and then obviously when you work on all these high profile cases, the natural next thing, and particularly before everybody knew the internet was going to be anything, the natural next thing would be to work at like a top tier law firm and
yeah.
then make partner and make $2 million a year and then 20 years later retire.
That is the path. Mm-hmm. One thing that was interesting in going to school at Stanford, I met a number of people, some of whom wound up going into tech. And I knew one of the early folks who went into Yahoo. But I remember sitting in the judges' chambers in Lower Manhattan and reading a Wall Street Journal article, this is 96, about the internet and about new businesses that are being formed. At some point, I don't know if it was then or a little bit later, read about Amazon and this Jeff Bezos guy starting to create the book marketplace for the world. And I actually thought, you know what? He's right. The way we buy books today is just wrong. And this is going to be something. And so that sort of stuck in the back of my mind that at some point in time, I want to be involved in what's next, not necessarily follow the same path that everybody before me tends to follow.
Well, you know, it's funny. There's like, let's say two paths that one can take. One is very filtered, and the filter is, okay, you go to school, then you try to go to a good college or at least get a certificate, then you go to a graduate school, then you get a standard, like let's say you're on the lawyer path, okay, you do some public service, then you work for a top tier law firm, and it's this whole filtered path which leads to kind of a definition of success. Then there's this unfiltered path where at some point you have to make a leap and say, okay, here's something I might love, I might have some skills for, but I'll have to develop new skills, and you try it. Often the unfiltered path could lead to much greater success, which obviously occurred in your place, but like what was the actual jump? What was your first jump?
Well, I think so. The first jump that I didn't take was deciding to practice law for a little bit after working for the judge. And I thought about it, but I wasn't ready. I don't think I was mentally ready to make that break. Mm. And it turned out to be a decent decision, but ultimately I wasn't a particularly great lawyer, and I realized that I wasn't going to be a great lawyer.
Why did you think that? How did you know that?
Well, I knew that because being a lawyer is a bit like coding. You have to concentrate all day in front of a screen, especially as a junior attorney. You're working on, let's say, a very complex contract. So you have to think about all the moving pieces of the contract. And I found that personally draining. You have to understand all that detail. And then when you're putting together a deal, there's all of that comes together in a closing day where you bring together all of the documents that you need to close the deal and you close the deal. Now, when I realized I was not going to be a great lawyer, I was working on a very big deal. This is like a multi-month project, many lawyers involved.
And you left all the documents on the subway.
Hold on. It was a stock sale, right?
Okay.
So what do you need in a stock sale? You need someone to pay you money, and then you need the actual stock.
Right.
So we had all these documents, probably literally a room this big filled with documents. And the one thing that we did not have, because I did not think to go get it, was the stock certificate, which happened to be in a safe on the other side of the country. So all of these people assembled, closing dinner that night. We couldn't close the deal. So that was embarrassing.
That's so, just being on, let's say, the other side. You could imagine too, being on the other side of that transaction where you're waiting for your cash. You know, and there's a saying, a deal's not closed until the cash is in the
exactly,
bank.
Exactly.
So that guy is freaking out at this moment and yelling at you.
Yes. And so what we wound up doing was,
There's
an arcane provision of the law where you can cancel that old stock certificate if you convene the board of directors and create a new stock certificate. And that's what we wound up doing, which took another several hours, had to get the board of the company on the phone. Very embarrassing for me.
Oh my God.
And so that sort of led me to believe this might not be the right path, but there were other things involved. And I realized I kind of needed to re-educate myself and learn more about the business side of what I was doing, which I found pretty fascinating. So that's when I went to McKinsey, a consulting firm. It's kind of known as a place where you can learn a whole new set of skills around business, and they happen to be hiring people who weren't MBAs, and And that took me in a completely different direction.
And then how did you get into, you know, actually being now, you know, executive in a tech company? You know, first you were, I mean, you were at Google for quite some time, and then you were the CEO of their Motorola division when they bought the Motorola. And then now, of course, you're at Dropbox helping. I mean, I want to skip ahead.
Okay.
And then we'll reel back.
Sure.
You, when you left Google, the biggest and best company in the world, for Dropbox, people probably thought you were crazy. Like, Dropbox was this little tiny company at the time. What were you thinking?
Well, when I joined Google, everybody thought I was crazy. It was a little tiny company as well. There were about
what year did you join Google?
2003.
Okay.
Yeah. So I kind of seen that. And the greatest thing, you know, one of the most exciting things you can do, I think, with a career, certainly in Silicon Valley, is help grow a company and be there early when none of the teams are in place and there's a lot of uncertainty and competition's really hard and you've got to figure everything out. That's the hardest part, but the most rewarding part.
But for every 1,000 people who say that, 999 of them will end up at small companies that never go anywhere.
That's possibly true. Some of them wind up at small companies that don't go anywhere, and then they find their way to successful companies. Okay. Don't forget, like Drew Houston, who started Dropbox, he had started a failed test prep software company. So Dropbox is his second company. That's very common. So I thought with Dropbox, you already had, you know, two incredible founders, super technical, really exciting problem that they're solving. Our belief is when you've got five or six different devices all connected, you're not going to want anything on the device. You're going to want everything in the cloud, and Dropbox helps you solve that problem. So global market already had a lot of revenue and usage, and I felt I could help Drew and Arash grow the company, and it's been an incredible ride.
And you're kind of, even though you say they're experienced founders, I sort of feel like you're kind of their Sheryl Sandberg, in the sense that you already had, you know, huge experience at the biggest company out there, Google, and then you had been running the Motorola division. So you kind of really were able to, I'm sure they were happy to have you on board, to kind of really take the ship to the next level.
Well, I think it's complimentary. I mean, I'm never going to be a founder. I think there are people like Drew and Arash are incredibly brilliant around product and technology. How do you take advantage of all the different technology trends that are going on, the way people are working, how that's changing, and build a product that satisfies a need that literally hundreds of millions of people use? That's an art, and that's an incredibly hard to do. And one of the things I think Drew has done well is he's always seeking out advice. So the way I met him was he scheduled a lunch through a friend of mine, and he just peppered me with questions for an hour about, you know, how did you grow your team? What kind of people do you hire? How do you organize your team? When did you go international? When you were at Google, when did you guys make that decision? Those sorts of things. And so he's always learning. And I think he thought that he could bring someone who can help him learn as well as help him scale the business. And it's been a lot of fun working with him and Arash.
I mean, I think it was Steve Jobs who said, you know, he was going after Dropbox at one point and you know, and he was interested in the storage space. And he said, listen, you're a feature, not a company. Like, how did you respond to that kind of feeling about the company?
Yeah. You know, people said that about Google. It's just a search box. That was the meme when I joined the company. What else can it ever be?
Well, you know, can I tell you a quick story? So this was in 2001. I was running a venture capital fund, and a company called Oingo was practically out of business, and they were begging us for money. We could have probably owned half that company and for almost nothing. And their whole business was, how do you help search engines monetize a little by forming auctions around buying keywords. So eventually Google bought them. They changed their name to Applied Semantics. Google bought them for 1% of the equity of Google, and it became AdWords and AdSense. And, you know, that's 99.9% of Google's revenues, or give or take. And I had said no when they had originally pitched, even though it would have been a great deal for us. I said no because I said, the search engine business is dead. So I was too stupid to recognize. It's hard to recognize.
It is very hard. And a lot of people said that about Google. When I joined Dropbox, the meme was it's totally commoditized space. You're going to have to compete against huge players like Apple and Microsoft and Google, plus a ton of small specialist players. There's no way you're going to be able to be successful, or that company's going to turn into a company over a long period of time. And now we're a $1 billion run rate company, you know, generating a lot of cash. So if you address a big market, a big universal problem, you can grow a business very big, very fast. And if you acquire the right engineering talent, in particular product and engineering and design talent, you can put that talent to work on both perfecting the product that you have and then inventing the next thing. And that's a proven path that you've seen Facebook follow and Google, and that's what we're doing.
You know, it seems like when you put it that way, it seems like you kind of have to be in Silicon Valley, actually, because how do you hire all that kind of talent? You know, it's just like why Mark Zuckerberg moved to Silicon Valley. Like, how do you, it seems like outside of Silicon Valley, where in the U.S., as mobile as we think society has become, where in the U.S. can you really find that kind of talent on the engineering side?
I think it's really hard. I mean, Drew moved to San Francisco as well. Once Dropbox got going, Drew and Arash to build the team there. Certainly, if you need people who understand scale computing, machine learning, AI, most of those folks are in California. If you're focused more on folks who are maybe a little bit more around media and the intersection of media and technology, New York is a great place. And there are pockets all over the country, but there tends to be a huge concentration in the Valley. The challenge for us is it's super competitive for people. So we have people coming to us who say, hey, I've got 8 job offers. I mean, it's insane. I don't know how you actually go out and get 8 job offers.
Right. But here's the thing. Like a good, an A-plus programmer, it's not like there's a bell curve of talent in programming. It's more like a power law. So it's like, here's one level of programmers, then here's the next level, and then here's the next level. And each one's 10 times better than the level before. So if you get one like A-level programmer, he really is worth 10 times, or she is really worth 10 times. The second level was worth 10 times the third level. So if you get all those A-level players, it's almost like they're priceless.
Yeah, the value that you have, especially once you've got a massive platform already, is huge. So if you can, for us, for example, if we can save 1% off our storage costs through some engineering innovation, that's worth millions of dollars to us. And often it's an individual engineer or a team of 2 or 3 who come up with that innovation. It's seldom that it's like 50 people who solve that kind of a hard technical
problem. Right, it's like 1 or 2 guys who decide to work all weekend and get it done before everybody shows up on Monday. Like they just work nonstop and they solve all the problems and it's done.
We do a week every year called Hack Week, where our engineers and product folks and designers just solve problems that they see with our current products or invent new products. And 2 years ago, one of our engineers attacked this issue of storage. How do I compress images in particular in a more efficient way? And he literally generated millions of dollars from an improvement to our compression algorithm.
Wow.
In a week.
That sort of feels like the Silicon Valley TV show.
It is exactly like this. And he actually had the Pied Piper t-shirt on the whole time that he was coding.
So, that's funny.
Yeah, yeah.
So let's. I have more questions about Dropbox, but let's reel back to Google. You're at Google and you're working for, you know, Larry Page and Sergey Brin, and these are like icons now in technology. I mean, they're still young, they're still growing, they still have decades left to go with Google. Their stories are fascinating to me. Like, what are some of the things you've learned from them?
Well, the first time I met Sergey, he interviewed me, and we went into his office, which was kind of a windowless room like this, and he was lying on his back, I think on the floor, because he had hurt his back. So he interviewed me entirely lying on the floor, which I thought was quite unique. But I learned a lot from them and from Eric Schmidt and everybody at Google, really. I think one of the things that Larry taught all of us is that you have to think very long term when you're at the beginning of some of these massive technology changes. So one of the assignments I had was, hey, come back. And I was a strategy person, strategy and ops at Google. There's a whole team there now, but I basically started that team. And one of the projects that we were asked to pursue is, hey, tell us what countries we need to be in. So what countries in the world should Google have a presence? And we kind of went off and did the typical business school like project, had a PowerPoint, came back and said, hey, there's 30 countries in the world, and it's going to take us 3 years to get into them. And I remember Larry saying, do you understand we get searches in 196 countries or from 196 countries today? Why don't you start with that number, cross off the countries that it's illegal to work in for U.S. companies to have a presence in, and then come up back with a plan to get into all of those places. That's how he thought. And this was you know, 2004. And his point was, what we're doing is everybody in the world's going to need what we have built. Figure out a way to get into those countries and to learn from what's going on there so we can build a better product.
So here's what I don't understand. If they already were getting searches from those countries, aren't they already in the countries? Or what does it mean to be in a country
so
for Google?
What he wanted to understand was, you know, Nigeria is very unique from Egypt. How are people using our product differently in Nigeria? What do we need to build for those countries? And he did something very unconventional. He said, look, I actually want people in the country, which is really actually hard. You have mm-hmm. to deal with a bunch of legal issues. How do you pay them? How do you hire them? What do they do? But that's what we did. We hired people in Thailand and Kenya and Egypt and Dubai and all over Russia, Poland, Czech Republic. And their job, well, we called them scouts. Their job was to come back. They weren't there to make money. They were there to come back to Google and explain to us what was unique about the experience in their country, both the kinds of things people were doing on the web, the technology limitations. So Nigeria was mobile first from the very beginning. There really was no wired web. And to my knowledge, there still isn't much of one. And so we actually got lots of learning. Like in Russia, for example, the morphology of the language is radically different than English. And our search engine, since it was originally based in English, didn't do a good job with Russian. So we had to change our whole morphology to compete better in Russia. So you learn all these things only if you have someone in the country who's smart, technical, and can come back and also has that sort of innovative spirit and wants to be part of something big and understands how revolutionary the internet can be for their country. You know, imagine people in Poland, the fellow we hired, he told stories of being in his basement as a kid listening to Radio Free Europe. And now he's working at a company whose entire mission is to enable anybody to get access to any information. So for them, there's a real affiliation with the mission as well. And that in the long run, that's been hugely beneficial for the company. Some of the best people at Google came from those places. And Google makes money in all of those places as well today.
So what do you take from that in terms of decision making? Like, it seems like ValuePage has this kind of almost reverse way of thinking about, like you said, you did this MBA sort of bottom up approach, and he kind of said, no, start here and go backwards. What do you take? What's your takeaway from it?
Well, I do try to apply that to my decision. So you ask, well, why would you go from Google to Dropbox? Because, you know, when I was joining Dropbox, even though it was small at the time, just play the movie forward. Where is it going to be in 10 years? It's logical to me that the company that pioneered this notion of putting your files in the cloud is going to have all kinds of opportunities and going to solve problems for everybody in the world. So I think that's really important. And a lot of people don't think that way. They think very linearly. That's how we're taught. As kids, that's how you're taught in college. As a lawyer, it's a linear type of legal type of education. So you have to rewire your brain a bit to say, well, what trends do I understand to be true? If I extrapolate that trend to its logical conclusion, what does the world look like? What does that mean for opportunities that I might want to pursue? Because going back to your first question, you could take the kind of defined path or the undefined path. I think the undefined path is interesting because you don't need to be the expert. Nobody's the expert. So you just bring kind of a first principles approach to the problem that you're trying to solve and design solutions for the business that you're in or the situation that you're in, rather than copying and pasting or someone else's, or just following what someone else built, you know, 50 years ago.
So yeah, it seems like to make any kind of predictions, and like you say, no one can really predict the future. No one really knows what trends are going to be around in 10 years. But let's take an extreme on one side and an extreme on the other side. So the extreme on one side is, I know for a fact there will be a winter, spring, summer, fall, you know, give or take. And that's like the extreme where I can predict. The other extreme is XYZ company that makes a thermostat to, you know, for the Internet of Things. I don't know if that will work or not. Like, I have no idea. Even though that's a big industry, I know the Internet of Things will grow, but I don't know if any one company will grow. So, like, why did I mess up so badly on my Google decision, you know, on my Oingo decision? Because obviously the search engine business was growing. I knew the internet was growing. Just because the stock market was falling at that time on the internet had nothing to do with the fundamentals of the internet. Like, where did I go wrong in my thinking, you think?
I think that it's very different to do what I did, which was going into a company that already had figured a lot of that stuff out. And it was pretty clear that they were, in both Google's case and Dropbox, they were on the right path. and the situation you encountered where there was no clear winner, and or maybe there was, and what you needed to think of it through a different lens, which was at that point in time, what didn't matter was making money, but what mattered was just getting a lot of people using the product. So I think it depends on the lens.
And I was thinking too much from a Wall Street lens, because you're right, it was eyeballs was the metrics, and there were still banner ads on search engines. Nobody knew that there was going to be this kind of auction environment for keywords at that time.
Yeah, I think that people get hung up on the specifics too much. I think if you're, let's say you're coming out of school now, like what can you predict with reasonable certainty? There's a couple to my mind. Electric cars are gonna be massive, and there's a company that just got funded that's making electric buses. Right? That's a completely different industry. They're gonna have to invent a ton. Tesla's already invented a ton of IP around what they do. There are going to be massive companies. Tesla obviously is going to be one of them that are based in that future reality. We're not going to be driving gasoline cars for much longer. All of our cars are going to be self-driving. It's obvious, right?
Right.
So there are some very obvious areas where you can just extrapolate what you know to be true now. We're going to be communicating with devices, all of our devices, mostly through voice, right? These things are all obvious if you think about them for a little bit. And then you can think about, well, what does that lead me to conclude? I don't know about investment, but I'm thinking more from a career standpoint. Where if I'm young and entering the workforce, those are the places that are going to be really exciting, and there's going to be a lot of change and a lot of opportunity and a lot of growth. And
I'm gonna ask you towards the end what skills young people should start learning now, or even older people who are thinking of switching careers. But what you said just reminded me of a scenario at Google. So one time I was visiting a friend of mine who I'm sure you know, who's fairly high up at Google, and he is in charge of a lot of Google's kind of experimental stuff. And we had gone to graduate school together, and a mutual friend of ours had created this great company that makes imperfect chips that one time out of 10,000, they'll make a mistake. And the idea is that's okay. The mistakes aren't so important, but they'll be 100 times faster. These chips are 100 times faster than regular chips. And I said to him, did you look at our friend's company? Because we all talk to each other. And he said, yeah, I've looked at the company. And I said, what did you think? And he said, well, it's great. It looks very interesting. But if you just use Moore's Law, eventually chips now anyway will be faster than those chips. So just, he wasn't solving a billion person problem. It was just a problem that was going to get solved automatically by the growth of technology. So he didn't buy the company. And I guess that's that style of thinking.
Yeah. So, and we apply that at Dropbox. So we had a decision a couple of years ago. The company grew up on AWS, on Amazon's web services. And we had a decision, do we move off of that onto our own technology and buy all of our own hardware and write all of our own code on top of it to solve our use case, which is a very unique storage and at our scale is very unique. And we just essentially had applied that thinking. If you look at Moore's Law, you look at the cost curves, you look at where the cost of a gigabyte of storage is going to be in 10 years, it's an order of magnitude, multiple order of magnitudes lower than where we are today. So for us, it made sense to not just kind of ride the curve that Amazon's going to create, but create our own curve and basically follow Moore's Law, to the decimal point over the next couple of years. You had to also understand how much storage we expected to have coming in, because extrapolate the growth of all of that data that we're getting every day, a billion files saved to Dropbox every day.
I mean, I think also you can do what I'll call Amazon's law right now, which is, Borders let Amazon be their back-end store, and then Borders went out of business and Amazon sells books. So you can't let
your competitor run your core asset. Yep.
And not only that, like, you deal with so much storage, you've probably, I'm just guessing, over the past 10 years, your Dropbox is 10 years old now, you've probably over the past 10 years completely rewritten your code base several times just to be faster because you're getting so many requests for access into the database. If you just use SQL, it's not going to be fast enough ultimately.
Yeah, so our engineers are constantly tweaking our sync algorithm, which is the core algorithm that keeps your documents synced no matter what device you're on. And now that we own our own storage architecture, both the hardware and the software, they're tweaking all of that kind of combined performance so that We ship bits faster. We get them to you more reliably. All of those things.
Now it's a different sort of problem, and I don't mean to be technical for the audience, but I used to be on the board of Bitly, you know, which is the link shortener.
Mm-hmm.
So they get, you know, billions of requests a month to, you know, every tweet on Twitter, you know, might be a shortened Bitly link, or Facebook or wherever, or Amazon. You know, thousands of companies use Bitly as their shortener, and once we realized, oh my gosh, this is going to be maybe 100 billion links a month being requested, we had to totally do everything
totally
from the ground up.
Totally redo the whole thing. Yep.
Because everything was just microseconds too slow.
Yep.
And you can't do that. You can't have, you're not allowed to have downtime. That was the key.
Yep. And at Dropbox, it's the same way. The sync engine has been rewritten multiple times. The sync client, we're rewriting all the time, or rewriting aspects of it. You have to constantly... The product has to get faster. The files are getting bigger, so you have to be able to compress data more efficiently and transport that data more efficiently over time.
And I wanna dive into Dropbox on a couple of different issues, but I still wanna hear like what more about. I'm just fascinated with Larry Page and Sergey Brin. I want to hear like some stories. Like, so what did Sergey Brin ask you on the interview? He's lying on the floor.
You know, he was asking all about how do you design an efficient organization that scales. And I think it's interesting because Drew kind of asks me similar questions, or did when I first met him. And he was interested in building an organization that would scale on a global basis, trying to create a consistent culture in that environment. And what processes do you put in place?
How did you know?
He was not asking. I didn't know.
Like, what did you answer?
I don't know what I said. I don't think I had a particularly intelligent answer, but I guess it got me through.
And so I'll ask the question: how do you build a business that scales?
Well, I learned more from Larry and Sergey and Drew on that respect. One of the things that we did at Google was Larry would review every single interview pack. So every hire at Google, up till probably 10 or 12,000 employees, Larry had a 30 to 50 page packet that was a resume, all the interview notes, any kind of papers that person had published.
Wow, 30 or 50 pages per person. Applicant?
And he would spend, I think they spent 3 or 4 hours in hiring committee, is what it was called, reviewing each of them with a couple of his senior execs. And for part of my career, I was based in Europe, and you would send your packet, you know, to them on Thursday, and Friday evening you'd hear, and you might get a note back, you know, we rejected this person. Here's why. You know, we don't think culturally they're the right person, and here's why we don't think they're the right person.
Well, why would someone not culturally be the right fit?
We looked for some area of severe accomplishment. So we wanted to see something unique in every candidate. It could be, you know, it could be the person who's running Europe now and ran the UK for us was an Olympic rower. Hmm. We had someone who was a judo champion, like those sorts of things, or a musician, or worked at a nonprofit and had some kind of amazing contribution. We wanted to see like a real person. We didn't want to just see people who were on the corporate track.
Right. Well, this is related to what you wanted to see: the unfiltered people took the unfiltered path as opposed to the filtered path.
We did, and at Dropbox, it's although we don't have the same hiring process, we do something similar in that we have no hiring manager can make a decision on an individual hire. You are interviewed both by your future peers, your future boss, their peers, and people who might report into you. So it's very much a 360 view. And then all those people get together and they discuss every candidate, and everybody's voice is equal. And if you don't have real consensus in that room about the candidate, about their values alignment and their ability to contribute, we don't hire them. We'd rather pass than make the wrong hire.
Let's stop to take a quick break. We'll be right back. So obviously Dropbox is starting to emulate the growth of Google. Once a team gets bigger this is almost an evolutionary thing. And Yuval Harari talks about this in the book Sapiens. I don't know if you ever had a chance to read that. But basically after 150 people, everything becomes, you don't know everybody anymore, and you can't gossip about everybody anymore. You have to have, what's special about humans, you have to have a story to tell, and people buy into the story. So if I'm in America and I meet someone from China, we might both believe in, I don't know, Christianity or the American dollar. And so now we can work together because we believe in some similar story. We find that story and we start interacting according to that. So it seems like this is related to motivation and management. Like one school got to be, I don't know, 10,000 employees. How do you continually motivate the people at the leaves of the organization?
Well, mission's super important, and having, just keep bringing it back to mission. You could be on the sales side, which is where I was, and you would talk about how you're empowering your advertisers, which often can be small businesses as well as big companies, to reach their audience and be successful in a much more efficient way than the old way of doing things. And at Dropbox, it's very similar. As we talk about the organizations that we're empowering, like there's an organization called IRAP, which is a refugee assistance project. And they tell us that they, since they implemented Dropbox, can reach 10 times as many refugees. So they're impacting 10 times as many people as they did before Dropbox. So we tell those stories and try to tell those stories over and over to give people a collective sense of what we're actually trying to accomplish as a team. And that sense of mission in any kind of growing company where there's all kinds of skepticism on the outside and there's all kinds of competition, it's super important to keep people focused on. Again, it helps people think more about 10 years and less about, you know, the next 10 days.
So how often is your messaging to employees about vision and about the overriding mission statement?
Well, we try to weave in stories about customers all the time. I mean, the at our all hands, we're always talking about a customer. We're actually having the IRAP folks come into the office on Monday and talk to our employees. We call them Dropboxers. We weave in stories about customers every week in kind of our internal blog, and it's very important. You can't do enough of that.
So on Dropbox, let's say I was going to create a competitor Dropbox. Here's how I see Dropbox. I could rent a bunch of space on Amazon if I'm just starting out. You've now moved off of Amazon, mm-hmm. but I don't
you
need
could.
To worry about that. And so I'm using all of their sophisticated support and algorithms. I can have a front end similar looking to Dropbox, and I could say, look, I'm going to give you all the space for free forever instead of you paying $10 a month for Dropbox. So that's attempt number one. Attempt number two is I could be Google and I could create the Google Drive and compete with Dropbox. Like, how does Dropbox compete with both of those ends? Because it feels like that in this business to consumer industry, I mean, then you have Box.com, you have competitors. So how do you keep branding yourself like nobody can touch us? Where's the moat?
Yeah, the moat in part is all of the connections that people have made and continue to make on Dropbox. The way Dropbox got going was I used it, I loved it, I shared a link with you, you signed up. It's a very viral product. And the killer app within Dropbox today is something that we call a share folder. So it's a folder that both of us can be in. We can both contribute documents or files into that folder and collaborate on that folder. So that actually—
But Google Drive also, you can do things like that.
True, but it's a little bit like Google Plus wasn't able to supplant Facebook once Facebook
right.
already got the kind of the graph going and the set of connections going. So we already have well over 500 million people using Dropbox. So it would be very hard to get that entire community to move, and because they'd have to replicate all of those sharing connections. So that's kind of that's one aspect. But what's equally important is we keep innovating on the product. So there are tons of situations, low bandwidth situations, sharing from an iPhone to someone on Android, where our competitors do not handle those loads well. They, you know, are the best engineers at Dropbox are on this problem, and that's definitely not true in our competitors, because our
even
competitors,
Google.
Sure, you know, Google ships lots of stuff, and the kind of the core thing that Google does is search and ads, and those places tend to attract, you know, rock star engineers. For us, it's core sync technology and our core Dropbox application. That's what attracts rock star engineers.
I feel like a lot of Silicon Valley stuff is all about valuation and who's making this kind of money and who's making that kind of money. And the companies that succeed and grow in valuation are almost like flavor of the month type companies. Like, oh, everybody likes social media companies this year. Everybody likes storage companies this year, or virtual reality companies this year. Dropbox, I feel, perhaps deservedly and probably deservedly, when you did your last big round of funding, I forget what year it was, 2013 or 2014,
yep.
raised $500 million or some huge number at a $10 billion valuation. At the time, you had about $400 million in revenues or maybe even a little bit less. And everybody was saying, how are you going to grow into that valuation? Now you're clearly growing into that valuation with a billion-dollar run rate, 10x revenues for storage seems normal. But at the time, again, it seemed like, was it ridiculous? Did it seem ridiculous to you at that level, or were you projecting into
again,
the future?
I think you just have to look really long-term. Like, think about Slack. I was rumored to be raising another round at $5 billion.
I'm an investor in Slack, so
maybe you know.
So, Godspeed. Amazon's looking at buying them for $9 billion.
Are you confirming that?
I'm not confirming that. No, I'm a low-level investor.
Well, but I guess the point is that you need to look at what these companies can become, not what they are today. And you do need to extrapolate out, because if you were looking at Facebook in 2008, you would have seen a company with a couple hundred million in revenue at most, and not very clear sense as to how they're going to get beyond on web kind of social, and is there an ad model there, and is a established brand ever going to put money into Facebook? Like, there are all these questions out there. But the thing that was hard, the hardest thing to do, was to get that momentum going and get those users engaging. That was the hardest thing to do. All the other stuff you can solve over time. If you don't have that first thing, you're never gonna be able to get into the ad business and buy Instagram and all the rest. And they had solved that super hard problem. And I think that's true for Dropbox. We had solved back in 2014. It was pretty obvious. We had solved that super hard problem of getting user adoption and user growth.
And plus that the viral aspect of, like, if you want to see my files, you got to sign up.
Exactly. You have all that going for you. You also have a super efficient business model, because when I joined, there was no Salesforce. All the money was made by people signing up on our website. And even today, that's the vast majority of our revenue. We have a sales team, but it's more of a set of Navy SEALs, not the huge army. And that makes it more efficient. And you can take your cash and employ it to hire engineers and build better product. And that's what we've done. So these companies, back to your valuation question, I think savvy investors who understand this, they see that those companies come up every now and then. And it's pretty rare when they have that product market fit, they have the beginnings of a business model, and they have that massive consumer adoption and or user adoption. And those companies can be worth lots of money over a long period of time.
I remember reading once, and I don't know if this is true or not, but Peter Thiel doesn't like to invest in a company right now until they hit a $1 billion valuation. Because at that point, then he knows that A, they're going to continue raising, big amounts of money, and they've already kind of had that adoption and so on, that first level of success. So they're going to keep growing.
Yeah, I mean, personally, I think there's two types of entrepreneurs and two types of investors or business people who join these companies. There are folks who think they can take something from 0 to 1, and then there are people more like me who think they can take it from 1 to 10. And I don't think I'd be very good at finding the next kind of company that gets from nothing to $10 million in revenue. And there's a class of people who are really good at that. That's not me. And I think Peter is saying he's really good at seeing a company that can, and understanding why it can go from $1 billion in valuation to some larger number.
But we skipped over one part of your career, which is that between Google and Dropbox, not really in between, but sort of related, but Google put you in charge of all their Motorola and mobile solutions. And now Android is the most popular operating system in the world. So it's more popular than Windows, which is a desktop operating system. Essentially, mobile has replaced desktop. Like, if I wasn't a writer, for instance, I don't think I would ever use a laptop or a desktop computer. I would just use my phone.
Yeah.
And that's probably the general trend of, like, my kids don't use computers, really. They use phones.
I mean, most people in the world, their experience with technology will be through a phone. I mean, not most, like the vast majority.
So the adoption of, not that you were in charge of Android, but the adoption of Android as being now the most popular operating system in the world is at least in part due to your contribution.
No, absolutely not, no.
I'm giving you credit.
Well, you can, but that's, no, Android, Andy Rubin started Android, and Google acquired his company.
Right.
But he spent years within Google building Android and building the ecosystem and building a set of hardware partners who would ship Android on their phones. And that was a battle, because You had BlackBerry, who was really dominating in the smartphone world. You had Microsoft and Nokia, who were trying their own thing. That was who the competition was. And then all of a sudden, the iPhone comes along, and it was really hard. And when Google acquired Motorola, Android had about 40% global share, and so the war was not by any means won. And there was a lot going on, but Motorola had both a handset division and a set of intellectual property that Google didn't have, and all of the other Android OEMs were being sued at the time. You'll remember, by Microsoft and Apple and others, and so by acquiring Motorola, you got both the handset business, but you also got the intellectual property, which provided some level of protection for Android and allowed it to flourish. But that had nothing to do with me.
But then you started running it. So what happened next?
It's hard. So we acquired a company that had lost, I want to say, $1 billion a year for the prior 5 years, and there had been this massive shift in computing from feature phones to smartphones, which meant you needed to understand a whole new set of things around software engineering, around systems development. Marketing became more important, and Motorola missed that shift. So they were starting a bit from behind. They had a very visionary CEO who said, "We're going to burn the ships and go to Android," and was one of the first OEMs to go to Android, Sanjay Jha. And so that gave the company breathing room. But it was still going to be hard against a Samsung or an Apple, who were off to the races at that point. So our job was to try to compete in this new smartphone world by winnowing down the number of products that the company was shipping and try to build a couple of brands that were lasting and global. And we shipped a product called Moto X, and we made it very simple. We had good, better, best. X was the high end. G was in the middle, and E was at the low end.
What do I got? I got the Moto here.
You've got the Verizon Droid.
Oh, okay. Is it good? Do you like it?
It is, although I use a Pixel today. I like the Pixel. But our job really was to get Motorola back to a growing business. Google made the decision that it was, because it was supporting Android, which a number of hardware OEMs were using, like I want to say over 100, it was not going to advantage Motorola. So we were run completely independently. Our employees weren't Google employees. The only support we got was financial. We didn't have any access to code or anything like that, which made it very hard because we didn't have any structural advantage in a market where you needed size and scale, or you needed access to like the ability to build your own screens or own batteries.
So it's almost like, so Google bought the business in order to basically protect themselves against patents, you know, as a patent protection, saying, "Oh, we're in this business, so that gives us this extra layer of patent protection." And then they said to you, "By the way, this is actually a business anyway, so we have to still run it, but we don't really give a crap about how it does that much."
No, I mean, we didn't say that. But the directive was, "Hey, this is a handset business. This is a growing market. Let's figure out how we can get this business back to success, and then we will figure out what the path forward is once we're on a better trajectory." And so that was the mission. How do you get the company back to where there are a couple of great products in the market, where there's growth back in the business again, and then we'll figure out what we do. And ultimately decided, you know, if we're not going to create any structural advantage for the company, we shouldn't own it. We should enable one of our partners to take what we built and go from there. So we sold it to Lenovo.
Okay, right. So you basically got it into shape. What did you do?
Well, we went from 45 products, you know, which when you have 45 products, it's really hard to do any kind of marketing around any single one. You can't concentrate your fire. We went down to basically 4. We shipped the first smartphone watch.
You're kind of going off the Steve Jobs model when he got back to Apple. Like, he trimmed all the products.
You had to do that. Absolutely had to do that. And you had to concentrate your best resources on fewer things, and then you had to put the marketing behind it and put the distribution muscle behind it. We then spun up a team that was focused on just on kind of new innovation, which wound up building the first Android watch. And now Android in the watch space is doing all right, but obviously Apple is doing quite well there. And ultimately we got enough growth back into the bit. We shipped Moto G, which was the best selling smartphone that Motorola had ever shipped, and then eventually we sold the company.
So at that point, then you were probably looking around. Is that when you said, okay, Dropbox, here I come?
Well, I had, so Drew had reached out to me, not about a kind of role, but more about like, hey, I'm trying to learn. And this was the conversation that I was talking about where he just wanted to pepper me with questions about how do you scale a business and how do you run your management meeting, those sorts of things. And, but I followed the company and just was always interested in what they were doing and where it was going. And I just started spending a little bit more time with him and with Arash, his co-founder, and got more and more interested in where they were going and his vision. And again, you couldn't really see everything. There wasn't like a roadmap from where we were then to where we are now and where we're going in the future. But you could see enough, there's so much love for the product. I would just start asking people, hey, you know, where do you store your stuff? Do you ever hear of Dropbox? Use Dropbox. It turned out that, you know, our contractor used Dropbox and my wife was using Dropbox.
How many users a day do you get right now? How many new users a day do you get right now?
I don't think we share new users a day, but we've been signing up many millions a month, for a very long time. So
when you called up Larry and Sergey and said, hey, it's been a great run, but now I'm going off to this new thing. What did they say to you? Did they say, hey, we're going to kill you with Google Drive?
You know, those aren't always easy conversations. But, you know, Larry's he's an incredible leader. And he's, as always, you know, very gracious in those situations. And if you think about Google, some of the more interesting companies in the valleys are populated by people who came from Google. And so I wasn't the first person to walk into his office and tell him that and tell him why. And, you know, I think he understood and respected that I was really passionate about helping a great entrepreneur build a company because, you know, he is a great entrepreneur and he has built a company. So I think he understood that.
And you know, with Dropbox, look, I use Dropbox. I upload all my files there, whatever. But there's a certain trust that never happened before in society. Like it used to be, I had all my possessions and I would kind of hold on to them and keep them in my house and even paperwork and photos and videos I'd put in, you know, VHS tapes and store them in my basement or a storage facility. Now everything goes to this, you know, mysterious cloud in the sky, which is essentially now Dropbox for most people. There's a kind of trust. Like, what happens? Could it be the case that trust is broken? Like, you can either be hacked so that all my files are accessible to someone else, or you could just disappear. And what happens?
Well, you know, our first value in company value is be worthy of trust, and it's super important. We know that user trust is what earns us the right to have a business. So we take that really seriously, and we invest a ton of resources, people, money on security. We have some of the best security engineers in the world working at Dropbox. That's incredibly important to us. But you know, we're in a world where people's things, their applications, their stuff is increasingly going to live in the cloud, and there are trade-offs. You can't physically see it like you could, you know, see your VHS tapes and go down and see and look at them, but you can access the same content that used to be on those tapes from any device anywhere in the world. And so, you know, as users, all of us make those trade-offs, and the trade-offs most people are willing to make is, hey, I this service, I'm going to trust this service, that the benefits I'm going to get are going to outweigh kind of the mental shift that I'm going to have to make from a physical world to a world that's much more digital and much more cloud-based.
And so for someone listening to this who says, okay, it's great for this guy to say he's seen all these trends, he's done well with Google and he will do well with Dropbox. Someone could say, I'm sitting in my cubicle or I'm sitting in my classroom or I'm deciding what to do with my career. What skills and trends are you seeing now that I should start learning if I'm going to be at the right spot 10 years from now?
Well, I think there's two different things. I think one is just having a curious mindset about what's going on and about how are things going to change in the next couple of years for what you do in your daily job, how you shop, how you communicate, and just being curious about those things, I think, is really important. I think in terms of skills, what's been really interesting to me is to see the whole rise of online learning. And, you know, Khan Academy was one of the first institutions really to show the world that you can learn real stuff on YouTube.
Well, the very first employee
Craig,
of Google.
Yeah, Craig Silverstein's there. Yeah.
Is that at the Khan Academy
yeah,
right now?
Yeah. So, you know, incredible mission to, empower and educate anybody in the world to the same level as, you know, the best private schools in the US. So I think that that is incredibly empowering, and you're seeing organizations like Udacity create programs that truly educate you in how to code, how to do. I was telling you, my son has taken a course around machine learning and has gone through a year-long Udacity program all online. There's a huge community around it. You take the class with other students, you learn from one another, and he taught himself Python that way as well. So I think you're going to see more and more learning and more skills being acquired way outside of the traditional classroom in people's spare time when they're on the bus, when they're in the tube, because you can access these applications anywhere.
What about non-coding skills? Like, not everybody's meant to be a programmer or an engineer.
Yeah, you know, design is another area that's really important. If you think about this is related to my field. So the constraints that the phone imposes or mobile device imposes really requires an attention to design, how the user interacts with the program. What are the decisions you make about the icon that you use on the application, about the menus, how those menus work, what you surface, what you don't? All of those things become really important because the space is so constrained. So design is a really important discipline that there's not a lot of places that you can learn that, those skills are in huge demand.
What about, like, how has sales and negotiation, how are things like kind of these basic soft skills, how have they changed with this new economy?
I think it's really interesting. Things like negotiating a deal and establishing mutual trust and having a relationship, those are always going to be important. But I think what you're seeing is a lot more of people are advantage when they are sharing what they know in a kind of very open and continuous way. And some people do that on social, and they kind of establish a name for themselves, a reputation, and that opens the door in many ways, let's say in a sales situation. Some people, I met with a CTO today who first thing that he wanted to do is just share a number of startups that he has bumped into and ask, hey, what do you think about this? What do you think about that? You know, people who do that, they tend to be very connected to what's next, what's new, what can help them. They tend to be really open and seeking to help other people. And they don't think of their career as like, it's all about me. It's really about how do I empower those around me, and that over time will pay benefits. So I think that's a little bit different than, again, going back to your linear path where it was just about kind of following that trail up. It's more about creating a network of people around you who share the same kind of curiosity and interests and can support you along the way.
I think that's really key, because I think over like people want to be an overnight success, but I think over a 10, 20 year period of kind of bit by bit making connections and helping other people without any expectation back, you build the 20 years later, you can make a call and people remember.
That's exactly right. And you learn so much along the way that you otherwise wouldn't have learned. And what one thing, what happens sometimes is you get these insights that strike you. So this person I was meeting today was saying, we're completely changing our approach to software. We're looking at active users as if they're consumer applications, and we're supporting those that have the most active users within our company. This is a 20,000 person company. And we're no longer going to buy those that are only used by 100 people. That's a completely different approach to being the CTO of a multi-billion-dollar company like that. And that was just an insight that was, free, so to speak, because we were just sharing ideas, but that's hugely valuable. And you only get that if you're willing to share what you know. And often, a lot of times things you don't even know are valuable until you share them. I think that's different.
So final question or two. Dropbox, when's it? Are you going to get sold? Are you going to IPO? What's the story?
So Drew's been pretty clear. We're on a path to creating a great company. We have all the hallmarks of that. We've got incredible technical team. We've got a great product. We've got great product market fit. We've got a great business model. And he's also been pretty clear that, at some point on the path to becoming a great company is likely to be, an IPO, but we don't have plans at this point.
And then for you personally, when do you realize enough is enough. Like, for instance, after Google, you probably could have said, oh, I'm going to write a novel now or become an actor somewhere or do something completely different, not technical. Now, obviously, you've been fascinated throughout your whole career about the technology and the future and so on. But when do you decide, oh, I'm going to take 10 years off and get better at golf?
You know, I try golf. I'm horrible at it. The person that I kind of got to know a bit in the Valley is a guy named Bill Campbell. Bill's a coach.
Intuit.
He was a chairman of Intuit. He was a marketing exec at Apple, and then he was a coach. He was on the Apple board. He was a coach to both Apple or Steve Jobs and Larry. And he reinvented himself multiple times in his career. He was a football coach at Columbia and then somehow got into marketing in Europe, in technology, and somehow wound up at Apple and into it. And I think that's just a much more interesting life. I think that at some point it doesn't really become work. It becomes what you do. And I think that would be a much more fun path than
still staying than involved golf. And like changing the future.
Staying involved with companies that are trying to do great things, do big things in some way, shape, or form.
Well, Dennis Woodside, COO of Dropbox, one of my favorite companies that I use. I probably use it every day, actually, because my whole team shares. Like, we're taking a video of this podcast that will,
go
by
right
the end of the day,
go
on the Dropbox. Yeah. So, and obviously we trust it and use it. So, congratulations on all this success, and thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks. It's been fun.
Next time on the James Altucher Show.
I tell my daughter, who's 15, she thinks about college, even though I'm not as in favor of college as many people know. But
oh, wait, hold on, dude. to not talk your daughter out of college.
I know you teach at NYU. You've run a bunch of companies. You sold a bunch of companies. You failed at some companies.
Yeah.
You were on the board of the New York Times. But I just think college has become such a scam.
I agree with you, but here's the bottom line. Are we allowed to curse on this show, by the way?
Yeah, of course.
I just don't meet that many really successful people in their 30s or 40s who went to a top 20 school and say, you know what? I really fucked up going to Stanford. I hear that never. And some people might say college has become too expensive. I get it. College is not for everyone. Hands down, it's not. But if you're in a position to go to a good/great school as a young person in this economy, by all means, get to college. And if you happen to be Steve Jobs or Bill Gates or Mark Zuckerberg and you are so exceptional that you drop out of Harvard in your second year, fine. But assuming you are Bill Gates is a really bad strategy.
A lot of people tell our kids over lunch when they come speak to them, follow your passion. And I find that people who tell you to follow your passion are generally already rich. And I think people need to focus on find something you're great at and then become the best in the world at it. Establish real differentiation.
That's such an important thing. Like having a vision that is bigger or more interesting than the vision of the people around you, that's a winning path to success.
Mm-hmm. I think it's important early on to have a code. So take this back to unimportant stuff, business. What do all Fortune 500 CEOs have in common? Or I would say 450 of them when you meet them, and I've met a lot of them. They're really likable.
Even the ones that are also psychopaths.
Psychopathic, yeah. During the day, these people are Darwin and Darth Vader. Make no mistake about it. They play full body contact business and they make very brutal decisions. They dominate markets. They put companies out of business and they don't put warning labels on your iPad, even though your kid has a crack-like addiction to the thing, right? So they're just better at this than anybody else.
Hey, if you like this episode and want to hear more from the James Altucher Show, then subscribe and leave a review to help other people find the show. I would so appreciate it, and it's really important.